Before the Civil Rights Act passed in 1964, and for some years after, the discrimination most African-American travelers faced meant a long road trip required making special provisions to avoid possible trouble on the road. One of those provisions was the Green Book. Calvin Alexander Ramsey's a playwright and an artist, and he's looked into this special travel directory that began circulating around African-American communities back in the 1930s. The Green Book listed gas stations, stores, restaurants, beauty parlors, hotels, and guest houses where their business was welcome. He's written a children's book called Ruth and the Green Book, which has received a number of prestigious awards. It depicts a family road trip to visit out-of-town relatives from the perspective of a black schoolgirl named Ruth. Calvin joins us right now on Travel with Rick Steves from the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Calvin, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about this era of Jim Crow as it applies to black Americans who wanted to get out on the road and take their families on a vacation, or if somebody who was working and had to make a road trip, what sort of challenges they would encounter up until the 1960s?
Well, it was very difficult. Up until World War II, African Americans weren't really migrating a whole lot. But after World War II, they really got on the open road and they started buying automobiles. And that's when it really presented a problem on the open road, because there were so many places where they could not get service or have accommodations on the open road. So traveling by car was really a serious problem for African Americans during this great migration period, when as many as 6 to 8 million African Americans migrated from the South to the North and also to the West.
What is the name, the Green Book? Where does that come from?
Well, the name comes from this African American mailman in Harlem named Victor Hugo Green. He was a postal worker, and he would take his wife and family down to Richmond, Virginia every summer. And every summer he would have problems, places to stay, using the restroom, overnight lodging. And so he went back to New York. Instead of getting angry, he decided to do something about it. And he belonged to a union within the federal government called the National Association of Postal and Federal Employees. And through that organization, he was able to reach out to other mailmen throughout the country, African-American mailmen, because during that period, African-American mailmen could only deliver mail in black neighborhoods. And so they were able to ask people on their routes, would they like to be in this travel guide? And it grew from there.
This is up until relatively recent times, until the 1960s. Now, it was first published in 1936. It was called The Negro Motorist Green Book, an international travel guide. And then just its nickname was The Green Book. Apparently, it sold quite a lot. I know you're making a film, and in the research for your film, have you run into a lot of people who've used it? What are some of the anecdotes of black Americans who traveled and how this book helped them out?
Well, I interviewed a couple out of New Orleans who used the Green Book on their honeymoon. They vacationed down in Pensacola, Florida. I introduced another gentleman who used the book to drive his father down from lower Louisiana down to Miami, Florida. And a lot of folks that were traveling were not always entertainers or ball players. They were just average people. I interviewed a gentleman that works for Esso, which is now ExxonMobil, and he's one of the first blacks that was hired in corporate America. And these guys would travel to conventions and to association meetings, and they had expense accounts, but nowhere to spend the money. So they were really in a sort of a tough spot. And they relied on the Green Book more than anyone else, because the white-collar African-American during this period was on the road more than anyone else.
Right. There's an anecdote in this beautiful children's book, Ruth and the Green Book, and you talk about the little girl whose mom would pack a big lunch, and the kids didn't quite get it, but the big lunch was necessary because they may not even be able to find a place where they could stop to get a lunch.
Yeah, and in the children's book, Ruth didn't know why her mother was cooking so much that week as they were traveling from Chicago to Selma, Alabama. And in the children's book, the year is 1952. And back then, and up to the 64, when women would make these meals, and most of the time it was women cooking, sometimes men, they would cook things that wouldn't perish. So they would make pound cake, boiled eggs, raspberry tea, fried chicken. You could make anything that had, you know, mayonnaise in it or something that would become rancid on the open road, because a lot of these cars back then really did not have suitable air conditioning.
Calvin, when I think about this, I think about parallels with the Underground Railroad 100 years ago, and that, of course, gets a lot of attention in schools. But the modern-day story of African Americans not being able to be out on the road is kind of unnoticed. And do you have a sense that part of your work is shining a light on this?
Exactly. And there's a parallel with the Underground Railroad. In the book, you see that Esso Oil sold the Green Book at a lot of their stations, and Esso at the time was owned by Standard Oil, which was owned by John D. Rockefeller Sr. And John D. Rockefeller Sr. got involved with this project, having the Green Book sold at his stations throughout the country, mainly because of his wife. His wife's name was Laura Spellman. Her family was out of Ohio. They were abolitionists, and their home was part of the Underground Railroad. Her father was a minister, a Congregationalist minister, and he was what you could call a conductor on the Underground Railroad, which means that, you know, he was one of the people that would allow his home to be used for enslaved people who were leaving the South, making their way to Canada. So Laura grew up in this environment, and Laura's last name is Spellman. There's a college in Atlanta, Georgia, called Spellman College, which is an African-American college for women. And Rockefeller was one of the big supporters of the school from day one. The school's original name was the Women's Seminary College. Hmm. And he got involved in it, and he said, if you would change the name of this school to honor my wife and her family, I would make sure proceeds from my foundation would come to this school every year. And the name of the school was changed. And if you went on campus today, you would see a portrait of a minister, Spellman, in administration hall and his wife. And the church on campus is called Sister Chapel, and it's named after Laura and Lucy, the minister's two daughters.
So that's very interesting that Rockefeller recognized the injustice here, and he happened to have a built-in distribution network with all the Esso gas stations for road trippers. So was that probably the primary way? I understand that, you know, when the Green Book was at its height, they were printing 150,000 copies every year. Was the Esso gas station where most people bought it?
They could get it there, but they could get it from Pullman Porters, NAACP, church organizations, mailmen would sell it, civic organizations. And once you got a copy, you kept it forever.
Man, I would love to get a copy of that. Is it like a collector's item now?
Exactly. You know, the book, when it first started out, sold for 25 cents. There was a library who just purchased one. They had to pay $5,000 for it.
Is that right? Oh, my goodness.
It's a rare book. It's 6x9. It would fit into the glove compartment of the car. And once you got a copy, you kept it forever.
You can go online and actually read every page. I browsed through it, and it's quite interesting. If people just Google the Green Book, they can find that.
Yeah, and it wasn't just in the southern states. You know, the Jim Crow laws were pretty much all over. So if you was traveling to Northern California, you would still be limited where you could stay.
That's right.
New England, the same would hold true.
Now, you did have tourist homes that are listed in the books. These are like bed and breakfasts, right?
Well, actually, they were just regular houses. They just called them tourist homes, just regular homes, you know, and there was no phone numbers. You would just drive up, knock on the door, and say, I see that you're listed in the Green Book. And so it wasn't no advanced planning or calling in ahead and saying we're on our way. You would just show up. A lot of times, the people wouldn't even charge.
They just had an empathy for the plight of African-Americans on the road and opened up their homes.
And it was African-Americans themselves, and they knew that they could be in the same situation. So they was kind of giving back and hoping that they could receive the same kind of service if they were on the road.
We're learning about travel with the Green Book circa 1952 right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Calvin Alexander Ramsey has written Ruth and the Green Book to illustrate what a family road trip would have been like for African Americans driving from Chicago to visit relatives in Alabama in that era. That's when Jim Crow laws made it difficult for black motorists to find accommodations on the road without the special directory that Victor H. Green published with a state-by-state list of welcoming businesses. There's more about the story online at ruthandthegreenbook.com. We've also got a link to a PDF of an actual Green Book from 1949. Notice that the cover has my favorite Mark Twain quote on it, "Travel is fatal to prejudice." You'll find that link in this week's radio program details at ricksteves.com. Calvin, tell us about the sunset laws. These are something that a lot of Americans don't even recall, and this would have been a devastating thing for African-American travelers in the old days.
Yes, exactly. If you're going through certain counties, there were, you know, signs posted saying you should not be caught there after sunset. in these towns and counties were throughout the United States. And if you got caught there overnight, you could really be in trouble, not only with the law, but maybe with the local citizens as well. That was something that people in cars were very conscious of, which is why a lot of African Americans, even with cars, chose to travel by bus and train.
You could accidentally be out all of a sudden at sunset and you could be in physical trouble.
Yeah. And also with the authorities, you could get arrested or have physical harm done to you and your family. And so if you were traveling with your family, you was always putting your family first.
Right.
And those things were foremost in the minds of the family that were traveling.
Kelvin, are there any physical memorials or plaques or anything to acknowledge this sort of modern day Underground Railroad, as you travel around today? Is there any recognition of these tourist homes and these organizations that opened up for Black American travelers?
Not really. There are some establishments that are still standing. I think in Atlanta, Georgia, the Butler Street YMCA is still in operation. It's not as popular as it was, in the earlier days, but it's still operating as a place where men who are traveling, businessmen, could stay overnight, or people working in the town could get extended stay as well. But a lot of these buildings have been converted to apartments or stores or torn down. But people who are a certain age have memories of the Green Book and how it all started and how it was so helpful to them on the open road.
Now, of course, we've come a long way, but I would imagine there still are some challenges for African-American and travelers. When you're out and about and when other African-Americans are traveling around our country, are there regions where they still face problems? And how has the legacy of this Jim Crow era survived when it comes to the Great American Road Trip?
Well, when I'm traveling, I'm 62, and if I'm driving and I see an exit, and if it's not a national chain, I'm still reluctant to pull off if it's late at night or early in the morning. Mm-hmm. So those things are still with you. Mm-hmm. It's almost like when you're working out, you have a muscle memory. you have a memory on this as well. Even though I was young when the Civil Rights Bill was passed, I was a young teenager. But the stories you hear and things you experience as a young person, they never don't really ever all the way go away. So I'm very conscious of that when I'm traveling, and I think a lot of other people are as well.
Kelvin, when did the Green Book actually go out of print?
1964. Mr. Green's dream was to go out of business. He did not want to print the book forever. He was looking for the day when the Civil Rights Bill would pass so that African Americans would be treated like other Americans in the society. So he was looking forward to going out of business. And I think he was very happy when that day came. And a lot of folks asked, what did he do after that? I said, well, remember, he was a full-time mailman. He had a day job. But he really wanted to, stop publishing this publication because it was, in a way, a very good thing. But also, it was helpful, but it was a little shameful, too, to have a separate guide for citizens in this great country.
Well, that was just one of many reasons to celebrate. In 1964, when the Civil Rights Act passed and Victor H. Green no longer had to publish the Negro Motorist Green Book, an international travel guide. Kelvin, I've got the children's book in my hand here, and I understand you've also working on a play and a movie. Tell us what else you're doing with this Green Book.
I had a play. The play had a reading in Washington, D.C. at the historic Lincoln Theater on U Street. In the play, Julian Bond, the civil rights leader from the 60s, played the role of Mr. Green. And since then, we had a world premiere of the play in Atlanta, Georgia, at Theatrical Outfit, and the play was extended for 2 extra weeks. And now I'm working to take the play to New York City to Lincoln Center.
And the movie?
Well, the movie is a documentary where I'm actually interviewing actual people that used the Green Book and have stories about the Green Book and how the Green Book was a major asset to them and their family traveling.
That'll be a little bit of living history then. That'll be good to collect that and save it.
Exactly.
Why did you write the children's book, and what do you hope children will take away from this?
Well, I'm old enough where my family could have used the Green Book. I was born in Baltimore, but I grew up in North Carolina, and we used to make those trips back and forth. And it wasn't long trips, but they were trips that would take a little time. And I remember my mother's cooking and they packing stuff. And sometimes we even traveled with gasoline in the trunk of the car in big metal containers. Because, the parents really didn't want to have any interaction that might, spill over into an incident. I had never heard of the Green Book up until 11 years ago. I was at a school one day and I was talking about the Green Book, and I told a young lady that I told a classroom of people that I'm old enough to remember my family could have used the Green Book. Mm-hmm. And she asked me, had I ever seen a dinosaur? And I said, well, it wasn't quite that long ago. But I was at a funeral about 11 years ago, and a friend of mine, a son was killed in a car accident. And I went to the funeral, and a grandfather came down from New York City. He was a retired mailman. And after the service, we were all in the backyard talking about different things. And he looked right at me, and he said, I was looking for a Green Book. It was his first time in the Deep South, and he thought he still needed one. And I said, what's the Green Book? And he started explaining it to me at the time, and I had never heard of it. And I was on the advisory board of Emory University at the time, Special Collections, Manuscripts and Rare Books. And I went over there, and they did not have a copy. So I went over to Atlanta University, and they had two copies of the Green Book. And they made me copies of copies. And from there, I started researching, and I wrote a play about the Green Book called The Green Book. Then I wrote a children's book. And in the children's book, on the dedication page, I dedicated the book to the young man who was killed in a car accident, Little Tony, because I probably would have heard of the Green Book eventually, but not in such a dramatic manner.
Calvin Alexander Ramsey, best wishes, and let's be thankful we don't need a Green Book today.
Exactly. Thank you. Like an old dusty road, I get away.
There's a lot to explore around the USA, and some of our listeners have sent us a haiku poem they've written about their travels, whether close to home, around the country, or around the world. Share your travel haiku with us in the radio section of ricksteves.com. Here are some examples we thought you'd enjoy.
Phyllis Baker from Seattle describes what she saw on a road trip through the mountains of Oregon. Graffiti on freights, high up in the Siskiyous, traveling art show. Jeff Sibley from Central City, Louisiana, stretches the haiku form a bit to tell us about a bike trip he made across the state, along its original state highway, LA-1. Louisiana's longest street. Great people along the way to meet. 500 miles pedaled to complete. Gail Weinstein writes us from Port Orange, Florida, to tell us about a famous nearby beach town. Choose sand or asphalt, cars along shore or racetrack, Daytona Beach, wow. And Karen Albright of Fort Wayne, Indiana, describes the scene in the car on a family road trip up north. Up to Michigan, ah, sullen teenage daughter, karma strikes again.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington by Tim Tatton with Isaac Kaplan-Wilner and Sarah McCormick. Our website is managed by Andrew Wakeling, and our theme music is by Jerry Frank. We get promotional support from Sheila Gerzoff. Rick produces updated walking tours to many of Europe's most popular destinations. You'll find the latest ones in Rick's Audio Europe travel app. Look for it at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll look for you again next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.